Dave, good evening. I can
Good
almost see you
evening,
in the dark
Steele.
there.
Yeah, I'm sitting in a dark corner in my house. I just want you to be able to see kind of my sunken eyeballs and my skull. That's all I want you to see.
It's like going to a Ray LaMontagne concert. A bearded guy sitting in the dark.
I've never been to one of his shows. He doesn't like the spotlight, huh?
I've never been either, but that's what I hear. I've got a lot to live up to, Dave. So last week we had Matt Brown on, and he's back. He was great the first time. The fans clamored. They said, "Bring us more Matt." Hard-hitting opinions on world affairs. So Matt, welcome back.
Hey, thank you. Good to talk with you guys again, Steele, Dave.
You're looking great, Matt. You've been working out?
No.
Hmm.
Despite that, you're still looking good.
Thank you.
Hey, it looks like I see over your shoulder, Matt, like dozens and dozens of records. Are you a vinyl collector?
I am, yeah. I collect records.
How do you organize your collection?
Oh, thank you for asking. So I've been waiting probably years for somebody to ask me a question like that. By genre first, and then within genre, by record label in alphabetical order.
Whoa, hold on. The labels are sorted alphabetically?
Yeah, yep. So
Wow.
for jazz, you would have Columbia and you would have Miles Davis in there. And within Columbia section, I'd have Miles Davis in alphabetical order with Herbie Hancock after him. And
So
oh,
a
wow.
lot depends for you to know the label that everything was issued on. That's part of your master
Well, and
organizing
that's
principle.
exactly when you get into collecting, that's kind of an important factor is record labels. You're looking for that's how you find out about a lot of new music as well, because you're looking for music on a certain label that you like or things like that. So labels are definitely important as a collector.
I used to feel that way about Merge. I was like, oh, anything Merge puts out, I would buy or listen to.
That's what you do. Yeah, I mean, and that's big, especially as you start getting into weirder and weirder music. I mean, you really rely on record labels and all that. And within, genres like jazz, that's key. You want to get those certain the blue notes and the impulse and all that other stuff. So.
So you enjoy jazz, Matt? Is that correct?
I do. I enjoy jazz. I enjoy more avant-garde jazz, though. I listened to your podcast the other week, and you had a professionally trained jazz musician on there, and a lot of the stuff that he was talking about, I just, like, in my mind, wouldn't have even considered that jazz. Like, I wouldn't ever consider listening to Frank Sinatra or Tony Bennett jazz, because I just don't know any better. And I just listen to the weird stuff, the guys who are just wailing and taking it out on their sax, That's it. That speaks to me.
John Zorn.
John Zorn, oh wow, yeah. John Zorn's pretty crazy stuff. He has stuff all over the map, but yeah, that's cool.
Sun Ra. We're talking Sun Ra and his orchestra.
Sun Ra and his Astro Infinity Orchestra, or many other variations of his orchestra's name. Yeah, great stuff. I list, John Coltrane, of course, Ornette Coleman, many, many other people. But yeah, I just like the guys who basically are just screaming and making obscene noises through their instruments. That's what gets me. I kind of came into jazz backwards, so I don't have as much of an appreciation for the finer elements and the earlier styles of jazz. Swing, not gonna mess with that at all. I just want it to be noisy and wild.
Cool. I think I should give it another shake. I think for me, what I really appreciate about, I mean, I really love folk music. I love blues music. And there's something I like about outsider artists and primitive art. I love Delta blues, and I love it when it's just a guy on a guitar that's not really trained, that's a little wild. And I
Yeah.
bet there's something for me in that kind of more experimental, looser jazz, freer jazz.
Oh yeah, something for everybody, or maybe not actually. It's probably for very few people.
I think
Wait,
Dave
so
turned his turn his mic off. He doesn't care.
I just went to the bathroom for a minute. But what do you? So you put it on the record player and you're listening. How does your family react to this kind of noise or music, as you might term it?
Noise would be a correct term for a lot of the records that I collect. They react negatively. I would definitely say it's. So I have a collection of rock and roll. You know, I love Neil Young. I love the Velvet Underground, things like that. So I mm-hmm. have family friendly records like that. And then I have, you know, my by myself, just harsh sounds that I connect with. And so there's a time and a place for everything. You know, sometimes you might want to play a trick on your kids, put on something that's going to mess with their equilibrium or something. But other than that, I mean, you don't want to play this kind of stuff for your kids.
So I have a question for you. This is a little bit of a departure from our plan, but I want three labels that you would recommend to our listeners that you think that we're unlikely to know about, or our listeners are unlikely to know about.
Okay.
But they should check out, that you'd say put out quality stuff reliably.
Well, for your listeners, so in the time that I've been listening to your show, I definitely get that you, you know, Dave, especially as a Silver Jews fan, the Silver Jews, most all of their stuff is on a record label called Drag City Records. It's out of Chicago. It's more rock-based. Drag City's great. Possibly the greatest record label of all time. I mean, I could certainly make an argument with myself about that. Tons of great bands, like-minded musician. Bonnie Prince Billy releases a lot of stuff on Drag City as well as his own label. A guy I really love, Bill Callahan, and also goes with Smog. On and on. I mean, 100 plus artists on their roster. Just most of it really great stuff, ranging from really listenable stuff like Joanna Newsom. That would be kind of like a more of a guilty pleasure stuff for me, to really, really esoteric, you know, strange stuff that's really out there. Drag City, definitely.
Holy smokes, I should have thought about that. I didn't know we were going to do this.
Well, I've got one, and I'll name a label, and you'll tell me what you think of them or if you know their stuff. There's a label called Tompkins Square.
Oh, my goodness, yes, I love it.
Yeah, I think Tompkins everything Square. They put out is fantastic. They've recovered a lot of really awesome folk stuff.
Great guitar-oriented like primitive American guitar stuff. Love it. Another label in the same vein would be John Fahey's label, Tacoma, T-A-K-O-M-A. And Tacoma put out tons of great stuff. Tompkins Square is kind of, you know, a modern day Tacoma, if you will. But yeah, great stuff. Love that label.
I didn't even know Fahey had a label. See, I'm getting educated. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, love that stuff. I would also, if somebody wanted to get into jazz, I would recommend a safe label to start with. John Coltrane made famous the label Impulse Records, and Impulse has some stuff that I could care less about early on, more swing, big band, stuff like that. And then John Coltrane joined up in the early 60s and kind of put them on the map more so, and got weirder and weirder until he died. And some of the stuff he puts out on Impulse is just out of control, noisy and crazy. But then you had like a spiritual jazz movement that went on, soul jazz, all that kind of stuff after his death. Pharoah Sanders, his wife, Alice Coltrane, great, great stuff that they continue to put out throughout this episode.
I know of Impulse mainly for their art design. I feel like I've seen a bunch of really beautiful,
very iconic
Impulse and Blue Note records that just looked gorgeous.
Absolutely. Yep.
Well, that's good. Starting point. So forget parenting. We're talking about Matt's record collection. Dave, any questions for Matt about the records?
I like all the things you asked him. I think it's great. Do you listen to records every day, Matt? Is it something that every day you're putting a record on?
Am I? No. I would like to, but it is kind of a commitment. You know, putting physical media is more of a commitment. And also, you know, you have to be there to flip it back over, all that kind of stuff. So only in certain settings do I really listen to them. I love collecting them. I do love to listen to them. I think that that's important. It would be dumb to only collect them. But yeah.
Because we, I have a small collection. I was listening to a bunch, and then the piece of furniture that holds the record started to break. So it's a lot harder to pull a record out now. And now I haven't listened to a record for like 3 weeks. You
Yeah,
gotta have good
totally.
furniture.
Yeah.
I want to recommend something for all of our listeners if you're interested in record collecting. There's a woman, her name is Sarah Ohala. She's a librarian, and she's married to a New York City producer named Alex Goldman, and she runs a Tumblr called My Husband's Stupid Record Collection. And what it is he's got 1,500 records, and she listens to each one, doesn't know very much about it, and then writes her thoughts about what the record was and what was on it and what it sounded like, and the album covers and stuff. It's pretty awesome.
It is. I'm definitely familiar with that Tumblr, and she wasn't updating it for a while, but I think I checked back recently and she was. But he's got quite a wide range of things, and I think it's a pretty funny idea. If my wife were to do it, she couldn't even, there would be no words for her to review a lot of, the things that I have. But I like that this woman is really committed to trying to understand her husband a little bit better. Kind of romantic.
This record is broken. What happened? Someone melted it. Oh, wait.
Exactly.
Yeah. I had a very large record collection that is no more. It's been disbanded. I gave it all away and sold some pieces of it. And I kept two pieces of vinyl, and I got rid of my record player, stylus, all of my extra heads, and I don't
Well,
regret it.
what'd you keep? What
Actually, I
you
kept a bunch. I kept probably 20 Donovan records, and I kept
Cool.
Beck's One Foot in the Grave.
You can't. I would never give up Donovan. Yeah,
I
number
couldn't
one.
part with it. I think I had
No.
almost everything he ever put out because my friend Jack was a huge Donovan fan, and I inherited part of it from him, and he used to work at a record store. I didn't remember if I kept anything else. I don't know. It was sad getting rid of it, but good because
It is, but
moving it's so heavy, and I moved so much.
yeah. You have to kind of get those things, collections. You have to pare them down every once in a while. I think that that's important, and you connect with the things that you really love. I think that that's a important part that if you neglect, it turns into something other than collecting altogether. So.
Yeah.
I'm just glad you hung on to Donovan. I still have some respect for you because you hang on to the right stuff still. Thank you.
Yeah, that Barabajagl record, really good. Jeff
Oh,
Beck
gee.
shreds on that.
Oh, yeah. Unbelievable.
Hail Atlantis, good song. Four big things we're bringing your way. One, off-the-chain sports team owners. Fast, hard-hitting. The worst people in the world, and some of the best people. We're going to talk about books of the year. We're going to do Unchained Melodies with the sports owners theme. And always, we've got book wisdom. Let's jump right in. People who own sports teams, it's a crazy phenomenon. There have been some real specimens of humanity. And I want to start us, since it's baseball playoff season, with some legendary baseball owners.
Yeah, big fan of this guy, Frank McCourt. I don't know if you were following this a few years ago, but
Is this the guy who wrote Angela's Ashes?
he also owned the Dodgers. I believe they're two different people because the guy that wrote that book, I think, had a soul, but this guy didn't. He huge divorce while he was owning the Dodgers, and he didn't really have the money to own the Dodgers, so he was just pouring everything from the Dodgers into his pockets, kind of letting everything go to waste. This around the Dodger Stadium, it was getting kind of to be a rough neighborhood. The whole stadium was not being taken well care of. And in the end, this guy pocketed, hundreds of millions of dollars of profit when finally somehow he held it together long enough to sell it to the group with Magic Johnson in it for, I don't even know, a couple $1 billion. So he was just basically schemed his way to owning the Dodgers for long enough to make hundreds of millions of dollars. I applaud the guy. It's amazing.
Everything you want in an owner. Nasty divorce, financial incompetence, borderline, what's the word when you steal money from your embezzlement? Borderline embezzlement and poor property management skills.
Classic skill, love and loss, you know.
So yeah, unfortunately, he no longer owns the Dodgers, so we'll just have to remember what he did.
You know, we had another former owner, and this is one of the rare exceptions, one of the high-powered females in the sports world, departed now, Marge Schott. I don't know who first suggested her, but she's a real gem.
Terrible, terrible woman, for sure.
Wait,
What's the
what
most
was
memorable
wrong?
piece of Marge Schott for you, Matt?
Okay, so Steele, you had pointed out earlier about her racism, and that is disgusting. I had forgotten about that actually. But and somebody can speak on that a little bit if they want to. But one thing I actually remember about Marge Schott, I listened to something where they were talking about how much of a cheapskate she was. And so she was this little old lady, white hair, she chain smoked, always had a cigarette in her photos. And she was such a cheapskate, wouldn't even allow her team to even be competitive in a lot of ways. And I remember this anecdote where one season they would fly into the city on the day of the game, the team would, because she did not want them to go the night before to save on the hotel bill for the team.
Classic. Good old Marge.
Oh, she could have been on our corporate hijinks episode. She's just a jokester with all her racism and cheapness. Oh my goodness.
She was kind of like the Donald Sterling, I think we'll get to him later, of the Major League Baseball. I remember when I was a kid, though, I used to have a Sports Illustrated subscription, and there was a big feature piece on her where they included a whole bunch of quotations, the things she had actually said to media members in the previous year, criticizing players who wore earrings, essentially calling them a homosexual slur, disparaging Jews as being all alike with lots of swear words in front of it, calling them sneaky. The one that really blew my mind, and I think that led to her downfall, was she's like a third generation German American immigrant, and some of her family were like prominent Germans. But she said, everyone knows Hitler was good at the beginning, but he just went too far. And that's like cardinal rule number one in America. You cannot say something positive about Hitler. It's just, you don't do it.
how you can if you own a professional sports team. Marge Schott got
Seriously.
away with this for years. It's
Oh,
amazing.
man.
So Steele, you picked another one that was pretty amazing. I was reading the article about this guy, and this guy's just he the first two we talked about were kind of sneaky. This guy's just awesome.
This guy is the. This is probably my favorite owner from any sport of all time. Bill Veeck, or Bill Veeck, I don't know how it was pronounced. He was awesome. He owned the Chicago White Sox. His dad was, I think, the owner of the team. He inherited it from him. This was the family business. They weren't making money elsewhere. They were making money from the team, and that was what they did with their life. And so his main thing in life was he just wanted the fans to have more fun when they came to the game. He was like the king of promotions. He did all kinds of crazy stuff. There was one where he put his players in softball uniforms, so they were wearing shorts in a Major League Baseball game. Didn't last because sliding didn't work so well, and the players didn't like it. He's the first guy to put players' names on the back of jerseys, which stuck. He put a shower in the bleachers for fans to shower on hot days. He had a promotion where he landed Martians on the field and they ran around like they were new to the planet. He did a burn a disco record night that had the game ended up being canceled because I guess fans brought thousands of records and the fire got out of control.
Yeah, it turned into
He,
like a riot. Yeah, that
yeah.
night is like infamous in baseball history.
He also had a night, a game where he let fans act as the managers. So he gave like 7,000 signs and they would hold up signs to vote for decisions. And that would be what the team did in the game, which is super awesome. He's the guy who hired Satchel Paige to play in the majors in his 40s. the Negro Leagues legend. He also employed a midget and put him in an actual Major League Baseball game as a pinch hitter holding a toy bat. A guy who was 3'7". He drew a walk because his strike zone was so tiny.
Maybe his greatest accomplishment. Amazing.
I just, a legend. And he was such a larger-than-life loving guy, apparently. He read it voluminously. He knew everything. He was just a really wonderful person. He recited rhyming poetry, even, Dave.
And I read, and a lot of his teams were successful. When he owned the Indians, they won the World Series. So he wasn't just doing all these ridiculous promotions. He was actually a good owner, bringing money in for the team and using it to make the team good.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of thing that's so often lost in the huge corporate sports world now. The sense of like adventure, risk-taking, fun. I think he had a promotion once where instead of giving every fan a moon pie, which is like an ice cream sandwich, he gave one fan 35,000 moon pies. And so like he was describing how that's the secret of making a great promotion, incongruity. It didn't cost them any extra, but it just made the situation really weird and interesting. I love that guy. I wish he was my uncle. He also had a wooden leg, Dave.
Yes, by the name of Smith, I believe.
Is that a limerick?
It's a joke from Mary Poppins. Hilarious. It actually killed the old banker, dude. That's how good that joke is.
Fatal. Bankers, turn the podcast off now. We're not responsible for any heart events. Well, that's baseball. We covered the bases there, if you get my drift. Let's talk football. Amazing owners in the NFL.
I don't even know what I was reading, and I saw a picture of this man, and I thought, like, I have to talk to Steele just about this man's haircut. Matt, have you seen Mark Davis's hair?
Oh, yeah. Where I'm from, we call that the King Arthur cut. It's unreal. I mean, there's not much else like it. You're not going to see that very often.
It is amazing. It's a full-grown man. Essentially, it's kind of like what Jim Carrey's haircut from Dumb and Dumber, except he's also sporting the mullet in the back. And it's amazing. I just saw it.
His sideburns are cut really high, too.
Yeah, they're like triangular.
And he will not change. This is his haircut. He's sticking with it. He actually has gone to the same barber for years. I think he goes well out of his way because he found the right guy that can put the bowl on his head in the appropriate way to keep cutting it like it. It is the most impressive haircut I've seen by someone that's worth hundreds of million dollars. It's better than Donald Trump, certainly.
So who are we talking about here?
This is Mark Davis, son of Al Davis, who took over the Raiders when his dad died.
I looked this up, Dave, and it might surprise you or might not surprise you to know. He is an unmarried man in his 60s, and he co-owns the team with his mother, let's say. You also sent me a feature about the life this guy lives, and it's incredible. He's got a amazing van that's world famous.
With the vanity plate of Raiders. It's like R8HRS, and it's like just like a normal crappy minivan. This guy worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and he owns that van.
He's never had a real job in his life. He's always just sort of worked for the team, and now he owns them. And he's like, his number one goal in life is to be like buddies and friends with the players.
Well, for years he lived with
Cliff Brant.
Yes,
yeah, Hall of Fame.
Who he negotiated? He was his agent and negotiated against his own father, Al Davis, to get. I believe that the article said that Branch still gets paid some kind of residuals off of that contract that he signed. And his father, as soon as the deal was done and they shook hands, his father kicked him out of his house and told him to go live with Branch.
I want to read a book about this guy. I wish there was like a – I'm not a big fan of reality shows, but I would watch that.
You know, you think when you look at him, you think, okay, this guy, he's missing something, you know, like he's not all the way
intellectually
there.
Disabled.
But reading the more you read about him, I think he's got it all figured out. Like, he's a creature of habit. He's found the right barber. He goes to the same restaurants. He does everything exactly the way he wants to do. And he sounds like an extremely comfortable guy, and he's found what he's passionate about, owning a football team. It's awesome.
He lives what he loves, you know? We could all be so lucky.
Never work a day in your life if you do what you love. I don't know.
Yeah, all you need is a father that owns a famous professional sports team, and you just need to make buddies with one of the best players and be roommates with him for like a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll work. Okay, Dave, you also submitted maybe the flip side of this coin, Dan Snyder, perhaps one of the most hated owners in sports, belligerently holding out with a clearly racist nickname for his professional sports team.
It seems so crazy. It's interesting how despised this man is because of a couple stances. One, he wants to be very involved in all the decisions with the team, and he's just bad at it. So the team's been bad ever since he's owned it. And two, he loves the name Redskins and will not back off of it. He loves that. And as long as he's alive, he's not changing it.
Yeah, I don't get it. I think when you're a certain, like, alpha level just jackass, you just would rather fight than change your mind, no matter what it is. Once you've committed to something, it's like death before dishonor. I cannot change my mind.
Yeah, he's going to spend the money exactly how he wants, on players he wants, with a coach he wants, and the team's going to be the Redskins, darn it, no matter what.
Yeah, he spends tons of money on mediocrity, which is, I guess, good for the players, so good job.
Thank you, Dan Snyder. Yeah, the whole city of Washington, D.C. is worse off for him being the owner. And it's interesting. Like, people probably hate him more in D.C. than any number of people. And really, it's just he's an incompetent owner that doesn't understand that name of his team is offensive. And he's hated for it, which I guess is okay. But it's just kind of funny.
You know, winning solves a lot of that, though. And if he weren't so incompetent, then I think the Redskins name, it would definitely irk a lot of people. And, you know, for all I care, he probably should change the name. But I think that so much of it just goes into how badly he's run this team into the ground. And it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. His stubbornness over the name change is indicative of a deep character flaw that also leads to his being a bad owner in other ways that people hate more.
So because he's the owner, I mean, if you're a fan of any other NFL team, you feel like you have hope, even if your team is terrible, because things can turn it around. The right GM might get hired. You might get the right coach. But when your owner is this guy, you just don't have hope. Your team is never going to be good.
You know, when you're thinking of sad sack owners with major problems, Dave, you I think suggested Jim Irsay. I read a story about him. He's like a hardcore prescription drug addict that basically enabled his lover's death, like overdose death. If he was anybody else, he'd probably be in jail. But he's a millionaire that owns a professional sports team. And they just cover for him, and he gets arrested over and over for drunk driving and drug addiction, and it's sad.
I think it was Matt, you were the one that suggested that guy, Matt. Right?
Well, yeah, and one thing that adds to the sadness for me is there was that 30-30 about the Baltimore Colts band, and it was pretty interesting, but they talk a lot about Jim Irsay's father in it, and who was the owner before. And he was a total alcoholic. I don't remember if he was a drug addict. And Jim Irsay speaks in that just about how sad it was. And then, you know, shortly after that came out, he was arrested with, you know, tons of pills, $29,000 in cash, which is pretty cool. But yeah, it's sad. It just seems like a sad story, if you ask me.
But if you're gonna get arrested, you want to have at least $29,000 worth of cash on you, because that is cool. You put that in the arrest report, like, this guy is awesome.
The thing about this, it was stashed in three locations. If you read the details, he had over $14,000 in a briefcase. That's like straight out of a bad movie. He had over $2,000 in his wallet, and then he had an additional $12,000 in laundry bags on the floorboard of his car. That's like a cartoon.
Yeah.
And then the NFL, he hardly gets punished for doing this. No. If like a player is picked up with the same things, they might be out of the league for a year, like serious consequences. Jim Irsay, I don't remember. I think he wasn't allowed to be at the draft or something like that.
Whoa.
And they did $500,000, but for a guy who carries 29 grand with him, I don't think that $500,000 is going to hurt.
No, he just had to check like 10 laundry bags and he found it.
How fascinating where he was going, possibly. I mean, because normally you would think that a guy with that level of power could have various people doing these types of things for him, but maybe this was just such a dirty deed that he had to do it himself.
Yeah, it seems if you're that wealthy, it seems like you just hire a guy. Hey, this is my terrible person guy. He's going to get all the prescription drugs, everything I need. He's going to do this for me.
The real sad thing for me about this Jim Irsay, and I think I read this long ESPN investigative article about it. He had a common law wife for his longtime girlfriend named Kim Wundrum, and I guess they did a lot of drugs together. He bought her three different residences. He was very nervous about being public about his relationship with her, but eventually they broke up, and about a year later she was found dead in her apartment, which he had paid for, of a drug overdose. You just feel like there's this terrible dependence in their relationship and all of this kind of volatility and drug use and stuff. I mean, he's in part, I think, responsible for this woman and her death, you know, and these very shady circumstances, and there seem to be like no legal consequences for him, and he's just kind of a slime ball, it seems like.
Yeah, money just puts you in a different category. It's interesting, it's sad, and also he's obviously got addiction problems, so that's really hard to deal with, man. Yeah, laundry bags full of cash. If I find like $20 in my pants, it's like the best thing that's happened.
Hey, well, let's talk about positives, football ownership. I live in Wisconsin, which is home to probably the greatest ownership scheme in any of pro sports. It's totally unique. The Green Bay Packers are owned by a community trust. It's actually prohibited by law, like the bylaws of the NFL, that any other team can be owned in this fashion, but they're grandfathered in. They're owned by, like, what, 50,000 members of the community who actually own the team and vote as voting members about decisions. All of their finances get released as a public report every year. It's like something out of the last century. Some like feel-good movie.
But it seems like that'd be so hard. Like who decides the GM? Do they vote on who they're going to hire?
I don't know. I'm guessing they have like business people who run the business and make those kind of team decisions. I haven't really looked into it, but just the idea that, like, a town of 100,000 people has an NFL team in it, and it's owned by the community, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It's nuts.
Have you ever considered Packer ownership, Steele?
Not myself, but I have family. You know, they bought shares with the last offering, and a lot of people here in Wisconsin buy the share. It doesn't get you anything, and they just frame it, and it's hanging on their wall. So it's like a point of pride. They're not just a fan. They're a shareholder in the team because nobody else can say that.
Oh, that's awesome.
It is kind of cool. So that's football. We got some basketball ownership, and there's some real gems here. We've got the male version, I guess, of Marchot, Donald Sterling. I think everybody's heard of Sterling by now.
And he is such a good mirror to Marchot. He's racist, very cheap. Just kind of a dirty old man kind of guy. But he owned a bunch of real estate, and he was brought to court multiple times on being basically a racist in how he would rent his properties. If you were a African American or Asian, you either had a more difficult time getting his property or had to pay more. And one of the anecdotes that I think is really weird is this guy, he would go to the games and he'd bring his friends, and more than once he would bring them to the locker room just to kind of show off the physiques of the basketball players, like a almost a zoo kind of experience. He'd just be like, just to show off these men, these bodies that he kind of owns. Just really bizarre.
Oh, it's so creepy. Fortunately, though, after that recording of his racist conversation with his longtime lover came out, he was forced to sell the team to former Microsoft executive Steve Ballmer. And if anybody on this list lives life off the chain, it's Steve Ballmer. He's like a spokesman for really awesome male pattern baldness. He's keeping it alive on the sides. And he is an enthusiast, a life enthusiast.
I love, there's just numerous Ballmer YouTube clips of him. He was the CEO of Microsoft, and he'll just come out and just be yelling like a maniac, running back and forth on the stage. This man's worth billions of dollars, and he's running back and forth like a bald, crazy person, just going, "Wah!
This company! Yes!" We were talking about lions or apes versus bears last episode. Definitely a bear, an enraged bear.
You know, I love how he owns that stage when he's at Microsoft and he's just running around. He's pointing at somebody in the audience. Like, can you imagine being in that thing? I've worked, you know, for big corporations before, and I've had company owners or bosses right above me who wished that they could do what Ballmer does, and they never could. This guy, if I was in the audience and he was charging around that stage pointing at me, I mean, I'm thinking I'm getting raped. Like, there is this guy, he's beyond, he's the most off the chain owner easily. Like you said, it's just another level. There's nobody like him. And what was sad was after, you know, he took over and he's crying courtside after every game, I started thinking, this guy's ridiculous. They need to get rid of this guy. And then all of a sudden I remembered what they had before, and I'm like, no, they need to keep this guy forever. He's the best.
Yeah, that's what it's like to be a Clippers fan, I guess. Their cross city rivals have a really interesting ownership situation as well. We want to talk about Laker owners for a second.
I love what happens so often in sports teams is the father has bought the team, did really well with it. He passes away, and then the son takes over. This happens with the Yankees, the New York Knicks, and of course, it's happened with the Los Angeles Lakers.
And the Raiders, we should mention. The
Well,
real
Mark
Tommy Boy
Davis,
situation.
and that's what these all are: Jim Buss, Tommy Boy. The Lakers had their worst season ever last year. They're just kind of in a tailspin, and there's kind of a button heads between Jim Buss and his sister Jeannie. We assume she's competent, but she may be a Tommy
By
girl. But
comparison.
it's really an interesting phenomenon in the world of sports. You don't see this in other multi-million-dollar industries, really, where just the incompetent son ends up in charge.
Yeah, it's true. I think the protected monopoly status of a sports franchise helps that, because even if you run it really badly, the team doesn't fold or doesn't get bankrupted or get replaced by a better company. It just is a sucky team until that person dies or sells it. So, like, the consequences of failure are pretty limited if you own a basketball team or if you own an NFL team.
And the way television contracts are going, the way live sports are becoming more and more important to advertising, there's just money pouring in. Like, I could go own a team tomorrow and do a great job. I'd be very profitable, even though I don't know anything. Like, just money's pouring in.
Speaking of money pouring in, can we talk for a second about the great Russian owner of Dave's favorite basketball team, the New Jersey Nets, your hometown team, Mikhail Prokhorov? This guy's living the dream. Did you read that feature thing that I shared with you guys?
I read through it. This guy is amazing. Probably my favorite anecdote I read from that story is that he was partners in this huge company with some other man. He got arrested for solicitation of prostitutes in France, So this guy was so embarrassed, he made Prokhorov sell his shares in the company, and then that's when the economy crashed. So he walked away with billions of dollars, and the guy that made him sell the shares suddenly is worth way less. So it was the greatest solicitation of a prostitute ever financially.
I have to say, that's good, but did you catch where he initially made his money? Where he first got rich?
No.
He graduated from the Moscow Finance Institute in the 80s, and he figured out, where can I go to make money in Russia? He decided to sell imitation stonewashed jeans in Russia. And that's where he made his first millions.
That's so cool,
I think that's
man.
also where Tommy Wiseau made his money. We should talk about him another time.
That's also where Tommy Hilfiger made his money as well.
Yeah. When he lists his top five passions, business, sports, food, so far you're like, that's cool. And then he's like, human interaction? I have a passion for human interaction? Who says that? That sounds very alien-esque or robotic. And number five, beautiful women. They're in a category apart from human interaction, if you notice that. That's kind of creepy. But he owns a basketball team. So.
It's beautiful. Human interactions in my top five as well. I love
Yeah.
it.
So there you
Oh,
go.
jeez.
That's Prokhorov. Do we want to talk about anybody else from the world of basketball?
I think it's worth mentioning James Dolan, especially as Dave, I think it was Dave, pointed out his music career. His,
Yeah, do
I
you
think his
collect
band.
his records? What label's he on?
They're probably really limited edition, small press, private press. I have not been fortunate enough. It's the other side of the country. I haven't had a chance to pick up, any of his records, see him floating around in the bins out here or anything, but I have heard some of what are they called? JD and the Straight Shots, I
Yes. I
believe.
think it's
It's not bad. It's interesting. Not really my style, but it's kind of cool.
I'm a huge fan of when a wealthy man hires musicians to play in a band with him. The results are always excellent.
High art. I want to talk for a second, actually. This is a lesser known story, but there was a documentary about these guys, the Silna Brothers, Ozzie and Daniel. They used to own one of the coolest named, coolest jerseyed teams of all time, the Spirits of St. Louis, an ABA team. And when the ABA was folding, they had a deal to take on a couple of ABA teams that came into the NBA. And everybody else had either folded or got bought out. And the Spirits of St. Louis were not going to be able to join the NBA, so they had to negotiate this deal because the Silnas hadn't folded their franchise. And as part of the deal they negotiated, they got in writing this sweet contract that said they get like 1/32nd, like a team share of the NBA's media rights, TV rights, in perpetuity, which means forever. And as the TV rights have become more and more valuable, every time the NBA signs a new deal, these Silva brothers get a fixed chunk for nothing, for having previously owned a failed ABA franchise in the 70s. It's probably the best legal deal ever negotiated. It's incredible.
That's what I want my job to be. One of those guys. I just want to be the third brother.
The long lost Silva brother, or Silna, or whatever.
I love
Silnas.
imagining David Stern just losing it every time that these guys get a check written out to him.
He's like, who signed off on that? I want his head. It's so true. All right, so that's our sports ownership. We've covered that. We've beat it into the ground. Owners are going to come back in our music section. We got a little bit more of that. But now we want to talk about literature, books of the year. I guess every one of us has read a book or two this year, and here's our chance to wow our listeners. Listeners, you're about to get some recommendations that are going to change your literary life. What's the book of the year
Boom.
at Dave Jensen's Universe?
So this year I graduated from nursing school as a doctor of nursing. So I spent a lot of time studying that. And so what I've focused on in my leisure reading has been, of course, genre fiction, which I know you love, Steele, primarily science fiction and fantasy.
Great. High fantasy?
I'm not sure what that term means, but I feel like it's high, certainly.
I don't know either. I just thought you'd know.
I don't have that much street cred with the fantasy kids, and maybe the fantasy kids won't agree with what I'm about to say, but you made a recommendation to me still a little while ago for an author, Brandon Sanderson,
Oh,
and
B. Sant.
I can't stop reading him. I love everything he's doing, and I'm reading another one of his series called Mistborn.
Cool.
It's a trilogy, but the first one, the first book is probably my favorite. It's just really interesting. This guy's, he would use the term world builder. He just builds a really interesting world and then writes really interesting stories within it. In this world, there's people that are called Mistborns that are able to, and this is, it's going to sound nerdy, guys, but it's awesome. They're able to ingest different metals like iron, steel, and burn them within them and use these metals to give them kind of powers to interact with the physical world. It's awesome. They, of course, have to fight this evil dictator that they're going to try and destroy using their metal burning powers against his.
Wow. So it's like a battle of trash compactors. This is like a recycling epic.
Well, it's fantasy, so it's set, in a time before
Pre-industrial.
machines. The main evil guy is worshipped as a god, but he treats the certain class of people as slaves, and so they have to rise up against him. It's a really compelling rebellion story built in this world of Mistborn. Where I was telling Howard about it, I thought he might like it, so he went to Brandon Sanderson's Facebook page. And still, that one of the first photos that pops up when you go to Brandon Sanderson's Facebook page, you're gonna love this, is him shaking hands with John Stopher.
What? Hey, John's video game's almost done. He's released his trailer. It looks awesome. We need to have him back on the show to talk about Brandon Sanderson and his 4D video game.
It looks awesome. He's really put some interesting work into it. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, thank goodness his girlfriend dumped him and he's got some great roommates now so he can really focus on his craft.
Oh no. Well, that's sad, but I was so excited to see him shaking Brandon Sanderson's hand.
Oh man, you picked a good author if John Stopher's on that train.
Did John have a girlfriend? Because I feel like maybe she's in the picture as well, so John might not want to talk about it.
Well, we'll have to just raise the topic on the air
Yeah,
and
I
find
know. Yeah,
out.
what can you do?
Hey, so my book of the year is about as anti-fantasy as you can get. Like imagining escape from reality. And then imagine the exact opposite. This is a book by an American poet who's now dead named Charles Reznikoff. And it's been out of print since 1978. It was just brought back into print by a really wonderful press called Black Sparrow. And the book that I'm going to recommend is called Testimony, a Recessive, the United States, 1885 to 1915. And essentially, these are just poems that are drawn from the legal records of the United States in that 30-year period. It's just essentially acts of violence and horrible things that Americans did to other Americans. It's like,
You're recommending this?
yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's so good and so depressing. But it's just story after story after story of things that entered the legal record that have these heartbreaking or just eye-catching details. And he doesn't embellish it. The language is super stripped down. He cuts out all the unnecessary words, and it's just the legal testimony about these things that happened. And what's really amazing about it is it's over 100 years ago, but it's the America we live in now. These issues of race, of violence, of gender violence, all the stuff that defines like our contemporary American moment, he's seeing it and he has an eye for it in the American past. It's part of what made our country. It's part of the story that shaped it. It's part of the experience of poverty in America. And there's also these beautiful human moments as well. It's just this really wonderful, incredible, long, hard book. And I just would recommend it to everybody who wants to think about what America is like and what America really was 100 years ago.
Do you take any hope from it, or is it just kind of a heavy darkness?
Well, I think the book doesn't seem to have an overarching purpose of providing you with hope or depression. It's literally just to document. It's like it's trying to tell history without a plot, it seems to me. Documenting what took place, stories that would otherwise be forgotten or buried in the legal record. He's saying pay attention to them because they say something about what America is and what happens that we don't want to look at or that might be invisible. Here's this story, and it grips you and grabs you, and it should make you feel angry and sad and wanting to change those things and to have compassion for people in those situations, I think.
So you felt, for you, it brought empathy and compelled you to think and want to do.
Yeah, I mean, it made me become more aware of like there's a complexity and there's a story, human story behind every one of those like ripped from the headlines kind of tales. And that for everyone that gets our attention, there are these ones that don't get our attention that also have human actors in them. And they're all tragic in their own way, but they're worth paying attention to and thinking about so that we can avoid them, prevent them, change them, transform them, and build a different United States so that the next century's recessive looks different than the last one, is my hope, I guess.
Well, I can't think of a more steel book for you to recommend than that.
I think it
That's
actually fits.
interesting.
It fits kind of well with Matt.
This actually segment was Matt's idea. So what do you got for us, Matt?
So actually, that book sounds really fascinating to me, and the fantasy book, Dave. That's a genre I have not tapped into, but it sounds pretty interesting. So this was hard. I mean, even though, like Dave said, I kind of suggested it because I wanted to hear what you guys had to say. I read a lot of books that I like truly loved on an equal level to this, but I think what sets this book apart for me was just the commitment. William T. Volman, and he wrote a book called The Dying Grass, and it is part of a series. Seven Dream series. I think that this is the fifth book that's been released in the series, and they all kind of focus on indigenous people and their encounters with European settlers that kind of come in and really ruin their lives. And so this book focused on the, I don't know how you say it exactly, I think it's Nez Perce Indian tribe. They were from an area in eastern Oregon. And they were a very peaceful Indian tribe and really well respected, especially by American settlers. But the government, it kind of just documents how over time the government comes in and just takes and takes and takes and makes promises and even makes legal deals. They would buy the land from the Indian tribes. And then decide, you know what, we're going to come anyway. And they would take. And they eventually forced these people off of their land. It's very sad. And Pullman does a great job of kind of building it up so that you feel how much the land means to these people. And essentially, they have battles. And it's a lot of the battles just stem from American greed and total unfairness, the brutality of the Americans that leads to the Native Americans to fighting back. But that's, that's never going to go well. And so they have the army chase them for, I believe, about 1,300 miles across
Holy
country.
cow.
Beautifully told. So the thing about the book is, and this is kind of why I feel like a jerk recommending it as my favorite book, it's almost unreadable for most people. So it's 1,300 pages long. Has 150 to 200 pages of glossaries and detailed notes at the end, which are actually incredibly useful and very interesting. And the way that it's written is Volman, not very much of it is like typical prose. Most of it is dialogue, but there's not any quotations or punctuation, things like that. It is just these lines. It looks like poetry. And then whenever, so it'll have a conversation and then when somebody has a digression inside their head or they think a different thought, or they think further upon that, they reflect further, it's indented in. The print is indented. And so that's how you kind of have to learn how to read this. And then it's further indented for another thought, and then another. And then it jumps back to the original where the dialogue starts close to the margin. It's really tough to read. It took like 100+ pages for me to figure out how to read it. But I think that all those things added in, and being so much dialogue, you truly get a sense of like what the people were feeling. It switches back and forth from cavalry members back over to the Native Americans, and you're just following these thoughts as they're going through these hardships. And it just kind of all culminated in one of the best books I've ever read. The original reason I wanted to read it, I read a review in the Washington Post that said it was the reading experience of a lifetime, and it cited, books that I loved like Blood Meridian and things like that. And so it really got my attention, but it totally was really a difficult read. But I think because of that, it was just one of the most memorable books I've ever read.
That sounds so good. I feel like Volman is one of those guys, and everybody says this, where he produces so much, his output is so prolific that it's someone that I don't even attempt to read because I feel like I would love him, but I just couldn't keep up. And that's such a terrible way to feel, because if someone's really good, you should make the effort to read them because they're really good, not just because they're daunting because they put out so much. But
Absolutely.
it's one
And
I'm going to read now.
yeah, I mean, this is my introduction to him, and I've picked up another one of his Seven Dreams series books since then, and I'll read it. But just an incredible author, definitely doing his own thing. It was crazy guy, and I know we've kind of message back and forth about that, but I think that that kind of adds to it, just knowing like how insane he is. And he's also a character in his book. He kind of defies like time. He's there in the past and in the present. So it's very unique, very different, totally insane dude. But yeah, great.
Like, what do you mean? What's with William Volman? What's his deal?
He has an obsession with violence and with prostitutes, like literal obsessions. Those are the things that make him eccentric.
Absolutely. He also, Steele and I have both read a profile about him where it details, because he has so much anger and angst towards the government, and he lives just a totally strange lifestyle and all this kind of stuff. He was a target by the FBI. They thought he was actually the Unabomber. And then later on, they moved it. They thought that he was the person who mailed out the letters with anthrax in it. And he only found this out because he was writing a piece on privacy, I believe. And he requested his FBI file, and it was like 700 or 800 pages long. And they only released like 200 pages to him. And he's like this crazy libertarian guy, and he just like creates art and writes prolifically. Like almost all of his books are, or like at least half of his books are like 1,000 pages or more, some well over 2,000 or 3,000 pages. And he releases books all the time. So it's impossible, I guess, to keep up with him completely. But he does have a few famous books. I think Europe Central is like his most famous book from a few years ago. But yeah.
The book that really caught my attention, it's called Rising Up and Rising Down: Some Thoughts on Violence, Freedom, and Urgent Means. I have the abridged version that was put out by Echo Press, but the full thing of this is 3,300 pages and was published by Dave Eggers in the group in McSweeney's. It's like this several volume thing, and it was nominated for the National Book Critics Award. It's just like a consideration of how violence works in the world, like all over societies, and it's took him 20 something years to write. And the parts that I've read of the abridged version, it's incredible. It just changed my brain.
Well, I'm glad that we all could recommend books that are at least 600 pages in length, so that, just some good kind of summer reads for people.
Give you another year to read them. We're the best of the year. You got to pack it all in. So those are our books of the year recommendations. We got to move on to Unchained Melodies. I was thinking we'd do this on the sports owner theme. We're going to play a song, a theme song, for six of our favorite sports owners that we discussed early in the episode. And the first one, of course, first among owners, is the great Mark Davis, Oakland Raiders.
Ah, Steele. And with Mark, there's so much to think about. But the only thing I could possibly focus on is his beautiful, beautiful hair. And this is one of my favorite bands, Pavement, and their biggest hit, Cut Your Hair.
I thought you were going to play Wesley Willis. Okay, we'll do Cut Your Hair.
I just want to dedicate the first line to Mark. Don't go and cut your hair, Mark. This is stick with what you're doing. It works, man. So, Steele, do you have a owner that you're willing to share music with?
Yeah, I've got Steve Ballmer. So Steve Ballmer comes out on stage, runs out, so high energy. There's nobody that could be more Steve Ballmer than Andrew WK. He's known for his party anthems, and I had a hard time choosing which of the party albums that we should play here, but I think we're gonna go with Party Hard. So this is Steve
Nice.
Ballmer's song. This is his anthem. Andrew WK, Party Hard.
When it's time to party, we will party hard.
I think they could also be the song for Mark Davis and Jim Irsay in different ways.
Oh, come on, Steele. Oh, yeah, Ballmer. You know that's on his number one played track on his iTunes. You know it
Yeah,
is.
seriously. He gets on the treadmill and he just rocks to that.
He's probably hired Andrew WK to come party with him a few times. Like, those are two peas
Seriously.
in a pod.
Super fans. All right, so Dan Snyder.
So I got the perfect one for him. This is a song that when it was first performed, probably seemed appropriate and fine. But as time has moved forward, we see that this song is very out of touch and actually blatantly racist at this point, but still endearing to some and still really enjoyable to a lot. And I bet Dan Snyder loves it.
Okay, so what's the song?
It's What Makes the Red Man Red, I believe, from Peter Pan.
Delivering an oration in sign language. What's he saying? He says, Peter Pan, mighty warrior, save Tiger Lily, make big chief keep glad.
Yeah, maybe skip ahead, even though that works well.
On the beach and on the beach and on the beach. Atom Firewood.
Great humor. It's aged really well.
It really has. Well. Yeah. Classic. Just like Dan Snyder.
Aging well. A classic. Everyone enjoys him.
Okay. I got one for my favorite. Since we talked about Bill Veeck, and I love Bill Veeck, this is a band. It's called The Baseball Project. They're a little bit obscure, and they're obscure in part because they're not super great at making music, but they have, I believe, Peter Buck from REM is part of the supergroup, and they've released 3 albums that are just baseball-themed songs, and this one is called They Played Baseball by The Baseball Project. It's just a regular history of baseball. Someone loved them all. They played baseball.
Yeah, really nice. I don't know what you're saying about their music talent. Great.
It sounds like a band you'd be really into, actually, Dave.
Sounds like a band I'd be in. That's what it sounds like.
It's true. Well, I guess we should close with the Silva Brothers, the guys who made the greatest deal in sports history. We got 2 options here. Anybody want to make a call on what we're voting for?
I want to hear. I don't want to hear Steve Miller Band. Let's hear Barrett Strong.
This is Barrett Strong's classic hit, "Money." That's what I want. Totally underrated background vocals on that. Those guys were, or women or whoever it was, were incredible. I'd love to have them singing at my house.
Oh, geez. I would too, as long as it meant that I was one of the Silva Brothers or Silva Brothers. Those guys are awesome.
Yeah. Well, I did a terrible job at keeping this episode short. So let's get that out of the way. But
it's bedtime here.
Yeah.
It's bedtime where I'm in my time zone, Steele.
It's almost 1 a.m. here. So, let's end this episode with a beautiful rendition of Book Wisdom. We have a master of American fiction.
So, I have a Don DeLillo Americana, which is not my favorite Don DeLillo book, but you guys were trashing the genre of jazz so much the other week. I decided if I ever came on this show, I might read what Don DeLillo has to say, because I think he would be a better salesman on avant-garde jazz than I could ever be.
You picked perfectly, because Dave's, I think, the biggest jazz skeptic, and he also adheres very closely to the gospel of DeLillo. If Don gives it a stamp of approval, how can Dave stand against it?
Dave turned me on really to Don DeLillo. He told me to read White Noise. I'd had it on my shelf maybe for a couple of years, and he finally convinced me to read it. It's great. So in this book, this character is kind of just a pretentious white guy. He is convinced he heard some Coltrane records from his college roommate, and he connected so deeply with it. He's convinced that it is a part of his being. So he's just kind of, you know, pretentious a-hole like me. And so he is later on, he's on a road trip with a strange man named Clevenger. So he says, the Cadillac averaged close to 90 and its windows were tinted bottle green for the benefit of Clevenger's sun-baked eyes, but he never tired of driving. We stopped only to sleep and eat. He made quite a few phone calls, met some people now and then, and several times parked for a moment at the edge of a town and gazed with an appraising eye. With an appraising eye at vast pieces of real estate. But these delays were timed to coincide with the sleeping and eating stops, and we were always on our way again soon enough. Clevenger loved the road. It was a straight line of marked length and limits, and progress could be made upon it only in the most direct of ways. Some snug lane curling through highest Bavaria would have destroyed his mind. He let me take the wheel only as a matter of form. When he was not driving, he talked hardly at all, and I thought the wheel might be his secret vice, the only circle in his life, and he was close to being lost without it. Time slipped forward and back, and nature was off-center, and I listened to the radios. We switched from car radio to stereo tape to Sullivan's World Shrinking Portable. Sometimes I was able to work out a lively mix, and statesmen or commercial announcers chanted beneath whoops of soul rock. Clevenger got a kick out of that and would tickle the accelerator and jab an elbow into the padded door. Most of the time I stayed with the portable, and the car was filled with the sounds of big beat, gospel, ghetto soul, jug bands and dirt bands, effete, near-lisping college rock, electric obscenity and doom, wild fiddles of Nashville, ouds and tambourines and lusting drums. And then with night I would twirl the dials to hunt for jazz, and with luck, I'd catch a scrap of Catatonic Monk or Sun Ra colliding with antimatter, and some note would pin together pieces of the spreading night, and it would all make sense for a moment, the mad harmonics bringing most of what was sane to those who ran with death, and we would head into the gulf of early light with that black music driving over me, and I would feel a stranger in my love of it, for I did not run with anything. Don DeLillo.
I love him. I love his writing. His ideas are so clear to me. I'm still not going to listen to jazz.
Ideas on jazz, huh?
Yeah.
Hey, the line from me that just got me was, the steering wheel was the only circle in his life.
Yeah.
That was good. And then those who run with death, he's talking about the music. Oh, man. Yeah.
And that's his first novel. He was working in like advertising or something at the time, and he wrote that. That guy's awesome.
Well, we've come to the end of another epic episode. We've covered everything you could want covered. You're welcome, listeners. It'll be soon, I'm sure, before Matt Brown comes back on. You've been a success, Matt.
Oh, anytime. Thank you so much.
it's bedtime for us now, Steele. You need to get home. Get to bed. You got a few hours to sleep before work.
I'll be back in the studio in a few hours. Yeah. Well, good night, everybody.
Off the chain. It's off the chain. Welcome to this world. It's off the chain.
It's a real common occurrence for people to tell me I look terrible. You look awful. Yeah, people always think I'm sick, like, all the time.
People just don't like your face and Snowflake, huh?
It's all over the place. No, they don't like it anywhere, man.
Well, some people just look unhealthy, I guess.
I already knew a lot of this stuff.